here today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the Sixth Circuit ruling on the Affordable Health Care Act. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question during this time, simply press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. Thank you. Ms. Lotus, you may begin your conference.
Thank you, everyone, for joining us on such short notice today for a discussion about the constitutionality, or how the Sixth Circuit just ruled that the Affordable Care Act is constitutional. Reminder that this call is being recorded, and if you have any questions, please get in contact with me after. Neera, do you want to kick it off?
Great. Thanks, everybody. My name is Neera Tandon. I'm the Chief Operating Officer of the Center for American Progress, and I oversee our healthcare work, and the Center for American Progress has been actively working with a lot of the participants in the amicus briefs. Let me just first say, looking back on looking at this decision, it's an incredible victory for the Affordable Care Act. It's the first appellate court decision, but most notably, and I think in a very striking manner, we have a Republican appointee, a Bush appointee, and a previous clerk for Justice Scalia, finding in favor of the Affordable Care Act and the mandate in particular as a proper exercise of the government's power. And I think what this case really demonstrates is that the litigation around the Affordable Care Act is not actually a litigation between liberals and conservatives. It is actually a litigation between two versions of conservatism, one which is an activist version, which is trying to use the courts to undermine political opponents as a weapon in the political strategy, and another form of conservatism, which is really conservative application of the law, an appreciation of precedence, a desire to be conservative with judicial power and deferential to the political process. And I think Judge Sutton's joining of the majority opinion and his work in this case demonstrates that there is a vibrant traditional conservative approach to the use of judicial power, and that the Affordable Care Act is on very strong grounds going forward. I think it is in the annals of the law, a historic victory for the administration. I'm going to introduce the rest of the participants on the call, and then we'll take questions at the end. First will be Walter Dellinger, who's been exceedingly active in these decisions, and obviously has authored an amicus brief in this, and of course was a former acting Solicitor General. After him will be Ian Millhiser, who is the Justice Editor at Think Progress and a policy analyst for the Center for American Progress. And finally, Cy Lazarus, who's a counsel at the National Senior Citizens Law Center. Walter?
Well, this was a complete vindication of the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act in two separate opinions, one by Judge Martin, one by Judge Sutton, both concluding that the act is constitutional. Judge Sutton's opinion will be especially influential because he is one of the most highly regarded appellate judges in the country, as he has been an active advocate before the United States Supreme Court. And has argued a number of major cases before the U.S. Supreme Court before going on the bench himself. Judge Sutton, I think the most critical thing he does is just simply obliterate the notion that this is somehow a regulation of inactivity. He correctly sees this as the imposition of an affirmative obligation. He notes that the drug laws, the drug possession laws require you, if you show up home one night and you have drugs in your house, you have an affirmative obligation to get rid of them. most importantly, and I think the most critical part of his opinion, appears on page 45 when he obliterates the inactivity notion by saying that by observing that, quote, no one is inactive when deciding how to pay for health care, as self-insurance and private insurance are two forms of action for addressing the same risk. Each requires affirmative choices. One is no less active than the other, and both affect commerce. And he notices in particular that in the affidavits filed in that very case, he notes that the affidavits filed indicate that the people would have difficulty paying for their health insurance, which makes it clear that they would be unable to pay for any catastrophic illness or accident that they might have. So that the plaintiffs in that very case, in the very case before Judge Sutton, are people who would, if they were injured, be transferring the cost of their care to other hospital patients. And that, he said, makes them active in the health care market. He notes that this is a facial challenge. That is, that the act is unconstitutional in all of its applications. And what's important about this aspect of the opinion is he makes it clear that the act is constitutional with respect to virtually everyone in the United States who has the requisite income and is able to provide insurance and is not on Medicare or have employment insurance. That is to say, he notes that, of course, it applies to people who are active. It applies to those who have previously had insurance because they've been in the market. It applies to those who have insurance on the day the act goes into effect. It applies to those who live in states that already have a mandate for people to have minimum insurance coverage. Why would the federal government have the authority in those states and not others? He notes that it applies to those that have policies that don't meet the minimum requirements, and that it applies to those who are under 30 who are only required to have catastrophic insurance against sudden ailment. All of these people, he said, are active in the healthcare market, and in fact, everyone is finding a way of managing risk. And the people in the case before him are managing risk by planning to have other people pay for catastrophic care if they're transferred to a trauma center or otherwise have other people pay for hospital bills that they would be unable to pay. So I think it's a thoroughgoing vindication that there's where he says that this as long as the object of federal legislation are economic and substantially affect commerce, then Congress may regulate it. And that's all you need to know here. He actually goes back and sees this as a simple case. This is regulation of two important interstate markets, and it does so by creating an incentive for people to have insurance. One final point. I think he did not have the benefit of the concession made in the 11th Circuit by Paul Clement arguing for the Attorneys General, but he advances the same notion in his opinion. That is, he noted that it has been conceded that Congress could encourage people to have health insurance by providing a tax credit. It's conceded that Congress could encourage people to have health insurance by requiring hospitals to charge them double if they show up. And it's conceded that Congress could encourage people to have health insurance by requiring hospitals to refuse treatment to them if they don't have health insurance. That means it's conceded that Congress can, quote, regulate not having insurance by providing an incentive for people to have insurance by all these other methods. And the least draconian method would be to provide a penalty of 2.5% on those that don't maintain minimum coverage. So I think it's an opinion by a very highly regarded judge that canvasses the entire array of objections that have been made to this bill and emphatically rejects each of them. I'll pass on to the next speaker.
All right. This is Ian Millhiser. I'm an attorney here at CAP, and I'm also a former law clerk on the Sixth Circuit. This was a great opinion today, and I endorse everything that Walter just said. But the most important thing about this opinion is not what was said, it was who said it. Jeff Sutton is a George W. Bush appointee. He is a former clerk to Justice Scalia. He was an officer in the Conservative Federalist Society's Federalism and Separation of Powers Practice Group, which is the intellectual incubator for conservative arguments limiting congressional power. And he brought that mission to his litigation career. He argued for limiting federal law's ability to protect people with disabilities, to protect religious minorities, and to protect children who are denied Medicaid coverage. You know, you hear Ken Cuccinelli talk about how federalism is an essential part of liberty. Well, Judge Jeffrey Sutton ate, slept, walked, and breathed that idea for more than a decade, and even he rejected the utterly meritless arguments against the Affordable Care Act. And he rejected these arguments in the strongest terms. You know, he said, if you read his opinion, he said that there was no basis whatsoever in the text of the Constitution for this argument. His exact words are, the relevant text of the Constitution does not contain the activity-inactivity distinction that is the entire basis of the plaintiff's argument. And he then went on to say that this distinction is too incoherent to work in practice. So this is a tremendous victory, and I'll conclude just by saying once again, this is a George W. Bush appointee, a law clerk for Justice Scalia, one of America's leading crusaders for states' rights causes, and he just rejected the leading argument against the Affordable Care Act. I think now would be a good time for the nation to collectively stop pretending that these lawsuits have any merit at all. And Cy, you're up.
Okay. Well, I concur in everything that Walter and Ian just said. I think that if before this decision came down or before the oral argument occurred a couple of weeks ago, if one could pick a single appellate judge that a proponent of the Affordable Care Act would not want to have ruling on this case, it would be Judge Jeffrey Sutton. So this decision is a tremendous victory and a big surprise. And I would stress that it's important not just because he will be viewed by the conservative members of the Supreme Court as an ideological comrade in arms, but he will also be viewed by people like Chief Justice Roberts as an intellectual peer. Even those who disagree with him about many things have absolutely no doubt about his professional excellence, and this opinion demonstrates it. He raises every kind of objection that has been made to the act in a very thoughtful and sympathetic way that the opponents of the act cannot quarrel with, and then proceeds, as Walter just said, to just knock them down and obliterate them, really. He ends in saying at the very end of his opinion that we're left with this intuition that somehow compelling people to buy insurance who don't want to buy it is somehow a invasion of freedom. And he then discusses that and ends in saying, it's just an intuition. It's really not an argument with any merit. And he also stresses that it really is not an invasion of liberty. I think one of the most important things throughout his opinion is that he keeps showing why the so-called individual mandate is no more coercive than other things that Congress could have done to encourage people to buy insurance, which everyone concedes is constitutional. And he then says, you know, well, how can this really be such a horrific invasion of liberty? So I think it really undermines not only the legal but the political case that opponents of the individual mandate and the Affordable Care Act are making.
Thanks so much, Cy. At this time, we would like to open it up for questions.
At this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. Again, in order to ask a question, please press star, then the number one. Your first question will come from Jeffrey Tuber.
Tubin.
With The New Yorker.
Hi. Walter, hello, everyone. I wonder if I could ask you to take this opportunity to speculate about what today's decision means in terms of the cert process. I mean, I am basically trying to figure out when or if this case will wind up in the Supreme Court, and there is, of course, the possibility that, you know, the administration wins all these cases, you know, the four cases on appeal, and maybe the Supreme Court denies cert in all of them. But I would just wonder if you could talk, you know, based on your vast knowledge, about how you think a cert petition is going to, or various cert petitions are going to unfold as we watch this process play out.
Well, it's interesting. It was going to be an interesting question, which would be the first of these opinions to come down. The plaintiffs in this case could, of course, seek en banc review in the to the full membership of the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. I think it's unlikely that they would do that. They're probably likely they would probably like to have their case be the case that the first case to go to the Supreme Court in terms of a cert petition. I think, assuming the court takes this, assuming the Supreme Court takes this case at all, any of these cases, assuming the Supreme Court takes any of these cases at all, we then have a very clear idea of when a decision will be made by the Supreme Court. And that would be because the cases will get to the Supreme Court if it accepts them sometime during the next term of the court. I would expect if the cases are accepted by the Supreme Court that the argument would take place in January or more likely February and possibly March. But in any event, no matter when it was argued, the court would decide it before it finished its October 2011 term. That term ends in June of 2012. So the one thing I think we can be assured of is if the U.S. Supreme Court reviews this, it will announce its opinion. I can almost certainly guarantee it will announce its opinion in the last week in June of 2012, no matter what happens. Now, it is possible that I've always thought there was some chance the court wouldn't take this case. You know, before the two district judges that the plaintiffs were able to choose, were able to choose the districts they wished to bring these cases in, before the two district judges, it seemed fairly clear that there just might not be any case made whatsoever to strike this this down. And today's opinion may provide a strong support for that proposition. If all of the courts of appeals uphold the law, then there is some chance the Supreme Court would simply decline to hear it and let it rest where it is. It is, in one sense, as Judge Sutton sees it, not a particularly hard constitutional case. He obviously thinks it's a difficult policy issue whether to have an incentive for people to buy insurance and enforce through a modest penalty. He thinks that's a fair enough policy issue, but he just doesn't think there's any constitutional basis for something that is so much a part of a regulation of economic and commerce clause matters. And if the other judges agreed with that, it could be that the Supreme Court would not even hear it.
I would also add to what Walter's saying that he stressed the point that normally you can't challenge a federal statute is unconstitutional on its face if there are applications of the statute that would be constitutional under the theory you're challenging it. And he elaborately shows here that is the case, that there are many applications of the mandate that would be constitutional even under the plaintiff's theories if you believed in.
Indeed,
a very conservative, a very kind of conservative way of deciding the case.
Well, but he also sort of paraphrased the famous Justice Jackson quote about we're not final because we're infallible, we're infallible because we're final. I mean, he plays on that by basically saying it looks like this case is going to go to the Supreme Court, so it's not like he pretended this was some easy case.
I think he did say under existing law, this is an easy case. Of course, the Supreme Court could change it. At least that's why.
Well, thank you all.
You know, its constitutional issue is applied to virtually all of its applications that he can imagine, I think, are constitutional. You would have to have someone who would show that they would never, one person might be able to bring a case showing they would never need to have health care, no matter how catastrophic were the circumstances in which they were medevac to a trauma center, no matter how many millions of dollars in costs that would impose, they had taken care of that financially, in which case they could be excused. They would have made the arrangements. Maybe it doesn't apply to Warren Buffett. Well, that's fine anyway, because he's eligible for Medicare. But in any event, I think it's an across the board vindication.
Are there any additional questions?
Yes, we have Nina Totenberg with NPR.
Do you seriously? I mean, I would agree with you guys that that having Jeff Sutton write this opinion is a very big deal. But do you seriously think that it will affect any current member of the court, of the court's most conservative block of four?
Nina, I don't necessarily think that the fact that the opinion is from Jeff Sutton will necessarily affect any justice. That fact alone will affect any justice on the court. But the power of the reasoning is quite compelling. And what his opinion ensures is that the one thing that you know the justices read carefully are the opinions below, and it is absolutely certain that the justices will read an opinion by Jeff Sutton with great care. And reading this opinion, they will see that he really deconstructs the inactivity notion and shows that this is just merely a modest incentive for people to arrange for health care insurance in advance.
And so that's why
I think that will be so persuasive on the merits with them, that I do think it will have an influence.
Can I ask you one follow-up on the whole question of timing? Several justices recently have made it very clear, have answered direct questions from reporters in background sessions, in which they've said that it does make a difference to them who the lawyers are when they're deciding which cases to grant cert in. And if they want to wait for the other cases, for example, for the case in which Paul Clement is the lawyer, the big case from the 11th, could that conceivably screw up the notion that the case would be heard this term?
No, because I think they'll have an opinion from the 11th Circuit in time for the case to be heard this coming term. I don't think they'll go beyond September or October, in which case they'll easily fit within the term, and I think the 11th Circuit judges would know that if the court wanted to hear it, they should make sure they have an opportunity to hear it next term. Now, I think there is, the justices may well find that there's a problem with the case in which Paul Clement is the lawyer because the state attorneys general, the court is highly unlikely to find the state attorneys general has standing.
Mm-hmm. But there still are individuals in the 11th Circuit case.
There are individuals in the 11th Circuit case, and the Association of Independent Businesses has its own counsel. I expect that one way or another we'll see Paul Clement before the court on this. If the court hears this case, I would think that one way or another we'll still see Paul Clement arguing.
Nina, and this is Cy. If I can just respond to the first part of your question, it seemed to me that Sutton was writing this opinion for a conservative audience, and quite specifically for the Supreme Court's conservatives. I mean, it really is an opinion which says if you are a thoughtful conservative and you analyze all the different issues that have been raised about the mandate, this is how how I think you're going to have to come out. And it really does a very good job of that. So I certainly don't know those justices, and you do.
One quick addition yes. to that, Cy, which is, Nina, your second question almost answers your first question. The fact that the justices say it matters to them in deciding which case to take, who the lawyers are that they'd be hearing from, means that it also matters to them who are the judges that they're hearing from when they're mm-hmm. when they're reading an earlier opinion. Jeff Sutton was always one of the lawyers from whom the court wanted to hear, and there were instances in which this court granted argument status as an amicus, which is rare for the court, when and because Jeff Sutton was the attorney for the amicus.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Nina, I'll add one more thing. This is Ian, and that's, while I don't know it's the case that Jeff Sutton, his mere presence on an opinion, is going to cause a justice to switch their vote, I think that Judge Sutton is a good benchmark, because he indicates that people who think like Jeff Sutton think that this law should be upheld. And the subset of people who think like Judge Sutton include his former boss, Justice Scalia. If anything, Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Kennedy are well to Judge Sutton's left on federalism issues. And so if Judge Sutton is the benchmark, and you assume that people who think like Judge Sutton or people who are to the left of Judge Sutton will vote the way that he did, we have probably at least 7 votes on the Supreme Court to uphold this law.
I'm not sure. I think I might take that bet.
we'll put some money on it later.
Okay.
Your next question is from Andrew Harris with Bloomberg News.
Good afternoon. This question could be addressed to Mr. Dellinger or any one of you. As those of us who have attended more than one of the appeals court hearings, each one has taken a different tenor, perhaps a different flavor. The setups have been a little different. Is one of these cases, more than the others, more likely to get a cert granted and go up to the Supreme Court? And if so, which one?
You know, I think that my guess is that they will all be, that all three of the courts of appeals will get their decisions out this summer, that the Supreme Court will not be granting or passing on any cert petitions before October at the earliest, since they're now on break. I think they will consider all the cases together in deciding which ones to take, and that assuming they hear it, I think they'll take more than one. I think they certainly would look to who the lawyers are that will be involved in the cases. Obviously, the Solicitor General will be involved in any case on behalf of the United States. But I think they might well take more cases than one.
Well, we have the Atlanta case, which involves, you know, half of the states in the United States, and is the only appeal right now in a ruling that invalidated the entire statutory framework after striking down the individual mandate as unconstitutional. Is that what kind of is one of my sources one expecting kind of a national case for this?
I think you were breaking up, unless it's me.
No, it's him.
Okay. And did you get the question? It was about the Medicaid issue, perhaps?
No, I'm saying it's the Atlanta case, perhaps because of the number of states involved, more likely to get...
No, I don't... they may think if 25 state attorneys general petition for certiorari, that might be a reason for taking that case in and of itself.
Okay, thank you.
Again, in order to ask a question, please press star, then the number 1. Your next question will come from Sam Baker with The Hill.
Hi, thanks for doing this call. I wanted to ask about a paragraph toward the end of Judge Sutton's concurrence where he says nothing about this view precludes an as-applied challenge as the mandate takes effect.
Yes.
And I just wanted to see if you could elaborate on, you know, what that sort of means and what that opening
what that means is that if there were, I think what that means is if there were anyone who could demonstrate that they are actually, quote, inactive, that is to say, not only had they not had insurance previously, did not have insurance now that's underneath the minimum. They had made arrangements that they would never be transferring their health care costs to other patients or to taxpayers, that somehow they had made arrangements they would never be utilizing health care, and that if they did utilize it, there's no chance that they would have unpaid bills. It would be hard to imagine who could make that showing, but I think Judge Sutton, I've always thought he's clearly right, that if you could make that showing, you could bring a case saying that the law shouldn't apply to me. There's already an exemption in the law for people whose religions have a non-medical-based form of healing and who refuse any medical care, that Congress has chosen to exempt those people. This would be an exemption for someone who somehow had arranged. I'm not even sure how you would do it, that if you're hit by a, your car is hit by a six or an eight-wheeler that, and you're medevaced to a trauma center, that you've somehow made arrangements that they won't treat you, or that you have, no matter what the cost is, you have the funds set aside for it. In which case, it would be fine to exempt those people from the either paying the 2.5% a penalty or from having insurance. I mean, it would not undercut the purpose of the act at all to let out an individual who had indeed made arrangements that they were never going to be active in the healthcare market without being able to pay the cost of it.
But the thing, the real point, I think, is just that trying to figure out who could bring an as-applied challenge is a way of trivializing the case against the mandate, because it's almost impossible, as Walter says, to imagine
right.
any such person.
Right.
And I'll add to that that if the Supreme Court were to accept this facial as-applied distinction that Judge Sutton suggests, it could have profound implications for the timing of lawsuits. Because there's a doctrine known as ripeness, which says that you're not allowed to bring a lawsuit because of some speculative belief that in the future you may have an injury. You have to have either an injury right now, or you have to know for a fact that that injury is coming. It's going to be very difficult on an as-applied basis for someone to say now in 2011 that I know in 2014 I'm not going to have any connections whatsoever to the healthcare market. And so the practical effect of a decision which created this facial as-applied distinction in this context would be that the lawsuits would probably be put on pause really until 2015, which would be the first time that someone would have to pay the tax under the mandate provision.
It's just a way of saying, as the government has said repeatedly, that virtually everyone is active in the healthcare market. And Judge Sutton says this is about how you pay for the activity in the healthcare market that you're inevitably going to that everyone is inevitably going to engage in. And if someone comes along, and that would be in 2015, which is the first time someone would owe a penalty. In 2015, you could say, I don't want to pay the 2.5% penalty on my income tax, and I don't want to maintain insurance coverage, and here is how I can establish that I'm never going to be active in the healthcare market in a way that would ever transfer costs to other patients or to taxpayers. And I don't know. The only people I can think of who are rich enough to do that, maybe Mark Zuckerberg. Most people who are rich enough to do that, like Warren Buffett, are already eligible for Medicare. So they the mandate doesn't apply to them in any event. But it's actually hard to think of how someone would bring an as-applied challenge. But if they do, fine.
Okay.
Thank you, everyone, for joining us today. If you have any questions, please email me at llodes@americanprogress.org. And this call was recorded, so you can pick up audio if you need it, and I will make sure to connect you with all of the folks on this call. So thank you very much.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. This does conclude today's conference call. You may now disconnect your lines.